Welcome to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. This week, we'll speak with Michael White. He's a professor of criminology at Arizona State University. We'll talk to him about a new study he co-authored about the effect of tasers on the cognitive functioning of those who get zapped. Then we'll speak with Mike Tomasky of the Daily Beast, who is in Nevada, for the Democratic caucuses. And finally, we talk about how the way we train police fuels the problem of hyper-aggressive policing with Chuck Wexler. He's the executive director of PERF. That's actually an interview from our archives. But first, a few quick items. The Secret Service seems a bit jumpy these days. An enthusiastic Bernie Sanders supporter got a call from them this week after he attempted to place an obituary for Hillary Clinton in Saturday's Las Vegas Review-Journal. He said it was a joke. He meant it to represent her political death in this week's caucuses, which makes perfect sense to me. And they told him he could be arrested for making a threat, at least in theory, but they weren't planning on it. The funny part of the story was the Review Journal's description, and I quote, "The man was seen leaving the RJ parking lot in a maroon Toyota Prius bearing several Bernie Sanders campaign stickers. A security guard said he was also wearing a Sanders sticker on his shirt." He was feeling the burn. He was feeling the burn in his Prius, which is just perfect on so many levels. Michael Isikoff had a report at Yahoo News this week highlighting something that I hadn't realized. Republican frontrunner Donald Trump is embroiled in many, many lawsuits. Isikoff wrote, and I quote, "Little noticed while he has emerged as the Republican frontrunner for president, Trump remains mired in litigation on multiple fronts." Isikoff adds that this raised the possibility that, and again I quote, "A Trump presidency could turn into what one lawyer who has sued Trump called a litigation circus in which a sitting president would be forced to submit to multiple depositions and even jury trials as a result of ongoing civil lawsuits." So add that to the slow-moving car wreck that is the GOP primary contest. We'll take a quick break now and be right back with Michael White. Stay tuned.
Avança o sinal e não percebe que o sol apareceu. Enquanto pode se esconder na sua casa, você não vai ver que o que importa é que você não está só. Oh não, você não está só. Eu não vou deixar nem mesmo se você quiser. Venha me ver, o sol vai se pôr. E outra vez eu vou estar perto de você. Oh meu amor, você não está só. Estou aqui para te proteger. Vamos viver pelo nosso bem. Só nós dois, não importa mais ninguém. Oh meu amor, já está partindo o trem do coração. Já está partindo o trem do coração.
Welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm pleased to welcome Michael White to the show. Michael is a professor of criminology and criminal justice at Arizona State University, and he co-authored a recent study that was published in the journal Criminology and Public Policy that looked at the effects of tasers on the cognitive function of suspects who are tased by police and security guards and whatnot. Michael White, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Joshua.
Hey, before we get into the details of the study, do we know how often police departments use tasers in the U.S.? Are there data out there, reliable data about their usage?
You know, I really don't think there are good data out there. This is a discussion that's been going on for a while with regard to the police use of force. And quite simply, there is no national level database that captures how often police use force, whether it be firearms or lesser forms of force. So the short answer is no.
But they are widespread. According to your paper, we know that 17,000 police departments use them. Your study is the first of its kind. Why do you think that there haven't been studies like this one in the past, given how long they've been around and how many police departments use them?
Yeah, the taser, the device as we know it, really has been around for about 15 years. There's a longer history with much earlier versions that go back into the 80s. But the version that we all know and recognize is about 15 years old. And as you said, there are about 18,000 police departments in the United States, and we're approaching near saturation at this point. The vast majority of departments have the taser or have some number of officers, if not all officers, that are carrying the device. The one source of information we do have, if you look at the company itself, they have estimates of how often the device has been used, and we're talking, you know, in the millions. So it's been used many, many times. There have been a number of controversies that have been raised, or questions that have been raised about the device. And some of those have focused on the physiological effects. I haven't seen any statistics recently, but the latest numbers I saw that there were approaching 600 or 700 people who had died after being exposed to the taser. And Amnesty International keeps a running track of these cases. In nearly all those cases, the death is attributed to something else, not the taser. But in some cases, it's been identified as a contributing factor. But really, no research has focused on the effects of the taser on the brain, on cognitive functioning. And I'm not really sure why that is. There's a large literature in psychology on the effects of electricity on the brain. It's just the connections hadn't been made. And the study that we conducted was the first really rigorous study to explore this question.
And let's get into the details. Can you tell us kind of in plain English about your methodology? Like, how did you set up the experiment?
It was very straightforward. We recruited undergraduate students at Arizona State University. And there was a pretty restrictive screening protocol that students went through. We had to make sure that they were healthy in all respects. We didn't want to put anyone at risk. So once a person went through the physical and mental health screening, they were randomly assigned to one of four conditions. Two of those four conditions involved a taser exposure. So for example, condition one, if they were randomly assigned to condition one, they didn't have to do anything. They were in the control group. Condition two was a physical exertion condition. If a person was randomly assigned there, all they had to do was punch a heavy bag for 30 seconds. And then the final two conditions involved the taser exposures. Condition three was a 5-second exposure with the taser. And then condition four was the combination of the previous two. So in condition four, somebody would punch the bag for 30 seconds and then immediately after that get a taser exposure. And what we did, go ahead.
What did punching the heavy bag achieve? So was that to stimulate the kind of physical stress that might be encountered when you're struggling with a police officer?
Exactly. When people are tased in the real world, they've usually either been fighting or fleeing, their heart rate's up, and we were conducting, you know, this in a hospital. So we wanted to as best we could mimic the real world condition. So we added that as a condition to try to mimic the elevated heart rate one might experience. And then we had the exertion only so that we could try to isolate the effects of the taser.
I got to tell you, it sounds like a tough experiment to volunteer for. Did the kids get pizza or something?
Actually, they received $200 cash for their participation.
Okay.
And the remuneration was the same regardless of which group they were in. So some students got $200 for not getting tased, and others had to go through the punching in the bag and the tasing.
I guess it'll buy a lot of ramen soup in college. So what were the results?
So what we found is, and we administered a series of cognitive tests. We had an advisory board that included neuropsychologists, and they guided us on which tests to select and which dimensions of cognitive functioning to examine. So we administered about 6 different cognitive tests, and it took about 20 minutes to run through the tests. And we did this at multiple times, both before and after the participants got their treatment, whatever that might be. And what we found was that the participants who received a taser exposure experienced significant declines in one particular dimension of cognitive functioning, and that was verbal learning and memory. And they were statistically significant. In some cases, visibly, you could see that the participants struggling with this test. But the other thing we found was that the impairment that was caused was short-term. We administered cognitive tests immediately after the exposure, and that's where we documented the decline in cognitive functioning. And then we administered the same battery of tests 1 hour later. And at the 1 hour point, basically everybody had returned to their baseline. They had returned to normal. So it was a short-term effect, but it was statistically significant.
And going back to the real world, so you have an encounter between a suspect and a police officer, a taser is deployed. What are the things that happen directly after that in terms of, so what are the ramifications for police policy in recognizing that you have a period immediately following the deployment of a taser in which a suspect is likely to have severe cognitive disability, even if it's temporary?
Yeah, but the question that guided the research was whether or not there is any impairment, and we found that there was. And then if there is impairment, does that inhibit somebody's ability to understand their Miranda rights and to understand what it means to waive those rights? Everyone is familiar with the Miranda rights from TV and the movies. You have the right to remain silent and those things. Well, when police are asking a citizen or a suspect about those rights, what they say is, do you understand these rights and do you want to waive these rights and speak to us? And the Supreme Court has said that the waiver of those rights has to meet certain standards, has to be knowing, voluntary, consensual. And if somebody waives their rights and those protections or those standards are violated, everything that the person says is cannot be admissible in court. So this was the context of the study. And, basically what we were looking at is if this impairment happens in healthy, young, well-adjusted college students in a laboratory setting, what might that mean for real-world exposures of citizens to the taser, where in the real world they're more likely to be unhealthy, they're more likely to be older, they're more likely to be under the influence of drugs and alcohol? What might that mean for those protections for Miranda waiver?
And what would you hope to see happen following the release of this study? How might it change police policy?
One of the things we talk about in the paper is whether or not departments should institute a rule whereby the questioning of suspects, the reading of Miranda rights and the questioning of suspects is delayed when there is an exposure involving the taser. And there are certainly circumstances where there might be an emergency, there might be an immediate need for questioning to occur. But in situations where a person has been arrested, during that arrest has been tased, and there's no immediate emergency or anything like that that requires that the person be questioned right away, why not wait 60 minutes to ensure that the person will be able to understand the rights that are being read to them, and then make a knowing, voluntary waiver of those rights? And so that's the issue we've kind of laid on the table, is whether or not this 1 hour, essentially a 1 hour moratorium on reading of rights and questioning citizens, should be instituted.
it's somewhat reminiscent of the 30 minutes, or I think it's 20 minutes, that they have to wait between pulling you over and administering a breathalyzer test to make sure that you don't have so-called mouth alcohol that would bias the results. So it sounds like that there is potentially an unknown number of people out there who have talked to police, who have given consent, and maybe would not have given consent if they hadn't been shaken up by the administration of a bunch of electricity in their body. Michael White, I believe we are out of time, but I really want to thank you for taking the time to share your research with us.
My pleasure.
Folks, the article, if you're interested, is titled Taser Exposure and Cognitive Impairment. It'll cost you a few bucks, but it was published by the Journal of Criminology and Public Policy. Stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then be right back. Welcome back to the show. I'm joined now by Mike Tomasky. Mike is a columnist for the Daily Beast, and he is the editor of Democracy, a journal of ideas. He just landed in Nevada, and boy, are his arms tired. Hi, Mike. Welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio.
Thanks. Nice to be with you.
So you're in Nevada for the big showdown, or I guess the first of a couple of big showdowns, because the Democratic caucuses in Nevada are on the same day as the GOP primary in South Carolina. Are you going to do some hard-hitting reporting, or just drink with other reporters at the hotel bar?
I certainly hope to do the latter, but sure, yeah, I'm reporting. I'm going out to after we finish this call, I'm going up to the culinary workers to interview some people and see what how they size things up. That, of course, is the big union here, Local 226, the big union that represents all the many of the hotel workers, not the workers at Donald Trump's hotel.
Right. Well, we're going to look forward to reading your stuff at the Daily Beast. There have been very few polls out of Nevada until this week. The state is notoriously hard to call. Why is it so tough to poll Nevadans? Are they just like wishy-washy and change their minds all the time?
That's it. Well, there's only been one Nevada caucus. You're supposed to say Nevada, by the way, Josh.
Nevada, okay.
Don't say Nevada out here, okay?
Okay.
There's only been one competitive caucus in the history of the state. So it's not like Iowa, where they've been doing it since 1976, and they have a decent sense of who comes out and votes in those things. Here, it's just harder to figure out who the likely electorate is going to be, especially with same-day registration. Now, the caucus is open only to Democrats, so independents and Republicans cannot participate. But you can show up at a caucus site on the day of and say, hey, I want to be a Democrat, and you can participate.
It's also tough just because you get turnout of like 10%, and it's hard for pollsters to know what 10% is going to actually get off their butts and turn off the TV and go down to the caucus. So it seems to me that while Bernie Sanders has made some real gains in the polls, the structure of the race has remained pretty stable in the sense that, you know, Sanders appeals to younger voters and white urban liberal types, but hasn't gained a lot of traction with people of color. Now we're going to Nevada. This is the first diverse state in the primary process. How important is this as far as his campaign?
It's really important for both of them. And I think, you know, the polls that we have seen, however accurate they may be, show it neck and neck. And I can totally believe that. As your listeners will know, Clinton was 20 points ahead here last fall. But that's before Bernie caught fire. And, you know, there's reason to think that the Latino vote is more sympathetic to Clinton going in general terms. But I think there's also reason to think that there's the same generational divide within the Latino vote that we've seen in the white vote in Iowa and New Hampshire so far. So, you know, and the Culinary Union did not endorse. And I'm sure that Clinton really probably wanted that endorsement and pushed for it. But I would assume, I'm going to find this out in a little while as soon as I go interview them, but my guess would be that their membership is divided.
Clinton secured the nomination of the Culinary Workers in 2008, if you will recall. Now, PPP polls reported this week that Clinton leads by double digits in 9 of the 13 contests on March 1st on Super Tuesday. Those are states that include Alabama and Arkansas and Georgia, a lot of southern states that have big African-American and Hispanic populations. So if he pulls out a win in Nevada, how am I supposed to say it? Nevada?
No, Nevada. Definitely.
Nevada, all right. If he pulls out a win in Nevada, in a state with a lot of people of color, does that change the picture going forward, or is that... or is that just Nevada, and it won't impact those states further out?
It's hard to know the answer to that, but you know, sure, if he wins, that changes the nature of the race because, you know, this was supposed to be a big state for her. This was supposed to be a gimme state for her a couple of months ago, and it's clearly not that now. And if he wins, he comes out of this and says, "You see, I can appeal to non-white voters," and that'll be the storyline. And you know, I guess it'll be true. And, you know, she'll have her back against the wall. I mean, not back against the wall in terms of, I don't think yet in terms of, you know, Sanders having like a 50% chance of getting the nomination. But, you know, she's going to have to fight a lot harder than she thought she was going to have to. And then the next question will be, okay, well, if Sanders was able to do this with Latino voters, is he going to be able to do it with black voters in South Carolina and elsewhere?
There are lots of black voters in Nevada as well.
There are, yeah.
And let's look at the other side. Let's say that the polls prove true, and that's, of course, unlikely. But for the sake of argument, let's say Clinton wins Nevada in a squeaker and then wins handily in South Carolina and then wins 9 of those 13 Super Tuesday states. Is it all effectively over, or does Sanders have enough states that might favor him later in the calendar?
Well, I think in terms of delegate count, it's probably, you know, pretty close to working its way toward being over if that happens. But that doesn't mean the campaign's going to be over, right? He's got the money to run until June. He's going to be able to raise a lot of money. So he'll keep contesting, and they'll keep having debates. There will be states, mostly caucus states, states that frankly are going to be red states in the fall, many of them, not all of them. Where he can still win, and so, you know, he will still have an incentive, even in that worst-case scenario for him that you just laid out. He'll still have an incentive to keep going and to get as many delegates as he can, because delegates mean leverage at the convention and the ability to, you know, maybe make the Clinton campaign take some positions that he wants it to take.
Now, according to the Real Clear Politics average, Sanders now has the support of 42% of Democratic primary voters. That's just 6% behind Clinton. So it really, we should note just how much this race has narrowed. Huffington Post has him 7 points behind, basically the same results. I feel like it's fair to say that most political analysts, most pundits, think Clinton would be a vastly superior general election candidate. So given how much is at stake in November, especially now we have an open seat on the Supreme Court, why do you think so many Democrats seem willing to take that risk?
Because they're not thinking about electability as much as they're just thinking about the compelling stuff that Sanders is saying. And, I think they haven't stopped to think about Sanders' potential liabilities as a general election candidate, which have to do with some of his lefty past, but I think more to do with the implications for people's taxes, to be frank about it, if he gets his program through. And I think, Democrats don't care that much about those things, but moderate independents and probably do, and certainly Republicans do. And Clinton hasn't run that kind of campaign. They've gone after each other a little bit, but I think this has not been a tough campaign yet between these two. And if she wants to hit him, she's going to hit on, how would you like to see your tax bill doubled? Because that's what the Republicans are going to hit him on. But she's hesitant to do that, and I think for good reason, because she doesn't want to alienate his voters.
It's been a pretty genteel campaign among the principals. Of course, everybody on social media is just vicious and has their claws out. Mike, I think part of the reason, though, is also because these voters were told in 2008 that a black guy with a middle name of Hussein would have a very, very tough time in a general election, and they saw him defy those predictions twice. So I think that might be playing into it as well. Yeah. Mike, are you going to stay in Nevada through Tuesday's Republican caucuses?
No, I'm just here for the D's. So I'm just here until Sunday. But, I'm going to catch a couple rallies tonight if I can, and go to a couple of caucus sites tomorrow and, see what I see.
That sounds cool. Let's talk about the GOP a little bit. Nonetheless, Trump has led the Nevada polls forever. What polls there have been, but his lead seems to be slipping. He was up by just 5 points, according to one poll released on Thursday. That was a 10-point drop-off since the previous poll by the same pollster. And I actually don't want to talk about Trump, because whenever I have a guest on and we start talking about that clown, we never stop. He's addictive.
Right. Yeah.
But let's talk about Marco Rubio. He is the one that everybody kind of wants or expects to emerge as the so-called mainstream candidate, the alternative to Cruz and Trump. Mike Tomasky, is he the most dangerous candidate for the Dems to face in November, or is he wildly overrated and not ready for primetime? And I guess both of those things could be true, given the competition.
Yeah, both of those things are sort of true. I mean, I think he is the most dangerous because he does a much better job. He's got a quite conservative record and has taken, in this primary some very conservative positions, like no abortion exceptions for rape and incest, and he said he wanted to abolish the federal minimum wage. So he's taken some positions. There are about three or four more like that that I think can really be hung around his neck in a general election campaign. But nevertheless, he's the best of the bunch at disguising that. Like Republicans have to disguise what they really think to sell themselves to moderate voters, and he's really good at that. At that disguise, and he seems like a nice guy. He just, like so many people, just say, I don't know, he looks like a nice guy. He doesn't look like he really believes those things. So, and he can do the whole future versus past narrative, which the media will buy. And this is another thing: the media kind of likes Rubio. I mean, likes him a lot. I mean, it's not like some people sat in a room and made some decision, but you can just tell by the tone of the coverage that the press wants a Rubio-Clinton race and kind of wants Rubio to win it.
Yeah, I get that sense as well. He is young, intelligent, and Latino. But Josh Marshall has been saying that he has kind of a fatal flaw in that he suffers from severe anxiety under stress. And certainly the amount of stress that comes into play during a presidential contest is immense. Eric Erickson reports, and of course we take that with a grain of salt around here, that Jeb Bush is telling donors that he'll drop out if he doesn't have a, quote, strong third place finish in South Carolina. Mike, you're a good liberal. You lived through eight hellish years of George W. Do you feel a little bit sorry for old Jeb?
Not really. I'm sorry. No, that's the wrong answer. But his heart clearly hasn't been in this from the start, and I would have had a lot more respect for the guy if he would have said at the beginning, you know what, I don't want to be president, you know? That's the way I'm going to roll. No, I don't feel bad for him. I mean, if you decide to jump into this pool, you got to swim, and, you know, you got to do what you got to do. And, it's not a game of patty cake. And, you know, Barack Obama was a pretty tough campaigner. I don't know. His game isn't there. And that's the way it goes.
Mike Tomasky, that is the correct answer. Do not feel sorry for old Jeb, because he's a Bush, first of all.
Yeah.
But he's just too. I mean, he is pathetic, and he's working out some sort of brother issue or whatever. It is clear, as you say, that he has no interest in at least the process. I mean, I think that he would like to be appointed president and have that role, but he is not into the campaign. And it's remarkable how much money they have wasted, his supporters have wasted, to get him to like 5% in the national averages. I mean, they've spent $70-80 million to get him to this point, and it's remarkable. So, all right, let's say Cruz and Rubio are in it for the long haul. Jeb and Kasich have to get out really soon to allow Rubio to emerge as the mainstream candidate, right? I mean, when does it become too late for the GOP to stop Trump or Cruz?
Well, I don't know enough to really know the answer to that question, because I don't know in enough detail how the delegates are apportioned. It's really complicated. You know, after March 15th, it's winner take all, but not really, because some of them are awarded by congressional district. Like if a person wins a certain congressional district, they'll get more delegates in that district than in another district. And there are these different thresholds in states before you get any delegates in the states that aren't winner take all. So, you know, it's just a delegate race, and it's really complicated. But yeah, as a general principle, Bush and Kasich getting their, you know, 7% and 9% respectively, presumably, if they were to drop out, the lion's share of that combined 16% goes to Rubio, and then that makes Rubio, you know, that puts him right up there in Trump territory. So a three-way contest between Rubio, Trump, and Cruz. That gets a little less predictable. Since the big states toward the end are mostly winner-take-all, can Rubio beat Trump in California? Maybe. I don't know.
Yeah. John Kasich has no chance. There's this kind of fantasy among some on the left, I think, that his somewhat sane candidacy can bring the GOP back from the brink. But I think he was basically built for New Hampshire, and when he gets to those deep red states, he's toast. And so let's say Trump wins this thing. On the one hand, he has the lowest favorability rating of any candidate in the field for either party.
Right.
But on the other hand, he has no ideological mooring, so he can really pivot to the middle for the general election. He's proven really adroit at dominating the media coverage, and he's been a celebrity with a top-rated TV show for a dozen years. How confident are we that Trump would be a horrible general election candidate?
I'm not that confident of that. I mean, you know, I could see him making some inroads into a kind of a working class vote more than some of the other Republican candidates, more than Cruz, for example. So I can see Trump making a state like Pennsylvania more competitive you know, I than Ted Cruz, right?
I could too. Yeah.
Michigan, something like that. So you have to think that most of America, that at least 51% of America, whatever they think about Hillary Clinton, if she wins the Democratic side, would say, oh, God, yeah, okay, I'm not crazy about her, but I do not want that guy to be my president.
Right.
So you'd have to think that'll be the basic, you know, emotional sort of response of a majority of people. But you know, he's risky. He knows how to control news cycles. He knows how to dominate, you know, the dialogue and all that kind of thing. And, you know, if when a campaign is mostly fought on terms that are defined by one candidate, that candidate usually wins.
Yeah, it's a scary prospect. And I forgot who said it, but someone said that, you know, there's an abundance of candidates who fulfill the kind of socially liberal, economically conservative slot, but there are very few that come out and say that they're that they're the opposite, and that Donald Trump could serve an underserved slice of the electorate. Mike Tomasky, I believe we are out of time. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me, and don't lose too much on the slots.
I'll probably stay away from the slots.
Folks, stay tuned. We'll take a quick break and be right back.
I got a star on my car and one on my chest, a gun on my hip and the right to arrest. I'm the guy who's a boss on this highway, so watch out what you're doing when you're driving my way. If you break the law, you'll hear from me. I know I'm a working for the state. I'm the highway patrol. Well, you'll know me when you see me, cause my door's painted white, with my siren screaming and my flashing red light. I work all day and I work all night, just to keep a law and order, trying to do what's right. If I write you out a ticket, then you better drive slow. I'm just doing my job, I'm the highway patrol. I'm the highway patrol, the highway patrol. My hours are long and my pay is low, but I'll do my best to keep you driving slow. I'm just doing my job, I'm the highway patrol.
Welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio. I am still Joshua Holland, and I'm happy to welcome Chuck Wexler to the show. Chuck is the executive director of the Police Executive Research Forum, or PERF. It's a D.C.-based think tank that studies policing and offers some really constructive recommendations for reform. And I find their reports really valuable. They've done stuff in the past year or two on issues like responding to active shooter situations, smarter crowd control techniques in the wake of the Ferguson protests. And they released a report in August titled Re-Engineering Training on Police Use of Force, which I wanted to highlight this week. You can find it at policeforum.org, all one word. Chuck Wexler, welcome to the show.
Hey, Joshua, nice to talk to you.
Chuck, in the report, you call for a major overhaul of how we train police officers, not minor tweaks. Before I get into that, as part of this report, you and your team conducted a survey of 280 police agencies across the U.S. Is the amount of training officers receive and the kind of training they receive broadly consistent between agencies?
You know, it's a good question. You know, you have 18,000 police agencies, 90% of which are 50 officers or less. So, you know, it's hard to get a handle on the kind of training that everyone does. But what we did do is, in the survey of those 280 some odd police departments, is we did ask them where they put their focus. And I mean, so from that sample, and that sample is mostly larger departments, you do see some common themes.
And that brings us, I think, to the crux of the issue. What do you think is most relevant in terms of how much emphasis is put on training for various elements of police use of force and other issues? And let's start talking about the training the recruits get.
Well, you know, police training is a function of preparing officers for what they'll see in on the street. And when we did our survey, what came across was a significant amount of time is spent on firearms training and defensive tactics, and a much smaller percentage of time is spent on crisis intervention, de-escalation, those kind of things, communication. And the reason that that's important and significant is when we're looking back at the past year at some of these situations, it's clear to us that officers, the way they're trained, makes them dependent upon the strategies they've learned. So if they've spent a lot of time on firearms to the detriment of de-escalation and crisis intervention, they're much more likely to use a higher level of force than might be necessary. And everything that we have learned here, but more importantly, what we've learned in England and Scotland, where we have been over the past few years, is the importance of communication, the importance of engaging, the importance of slowing things down in certain kinds of circumstances. Now, you talked about active shooter when you in the intro to our talk here, and that's interesting because on the one hand, everything we know about, say, active shooter situations sort of goes back to Columbine and what we learned there. And there what we learned was the prevailing thinking then was what was called contain and negotiate. So if you have an active shooter situation, you contain and negotiate and wait for additional resources to move in. Post-Columbine, that kind of thinking has been turned on its head. So now, if an officer responds and he or she is the first officer there and they hear gunfire inside, say, in an elementary school or theater or something like that, they're expected to step up and go in, even if it means risking their lives. And so on the one hand, we're saying officers should be prepared to move quickly where time is of the essence, and because you're it's between you and that gunman, how many people are going to die. And so seconds matter. So that's the way thinking about active shooters has changed. On the other hand, there are these other situations, not say of a bank robber running out of a bank or something like that, but where you get called, where someone is obviously distraught, emotionally disturbed, or somehow mentally impaired in some way. And maybe they have a knife, a stick, a rock, something like that. In those kind of situations, that's the ones we hope to make the biggest difference. Those are the ones where slowing things down, maintaining a safe distance, calling in additional resources, but most importantly, starting to communicate and starting at a lower level of force as opposed to a high level. So rather than immediately pulling the gun and aiming at someone, that just, you know, is an approach that we're really thinking there's got to be other ways to do it. And that's what we've seen in other countries where officers are not equipped with guns. They have to use communication skills and de-escalation skills in ways that most officers in this country are not trained to.
And I just want to emphasize this tension between the training that you go in and you immediately neutralize a suspect in an active duty shooting situation, and this need to evaluate this situation and slow things down. There have been two very high-profile police killings in Ohio in the last couple of years. John Crawford and Tamir Rice were both African Americans. They both held toy guns in their hands when they were killed by police. I should add that Ohio is an open carry state where it's legal to carry around real firearms. But the point that I wanted to make is that Crawford was shot and killed just seconds after he was identified by officers. And the same was true of Tamir Rice. They really did not take enough time, or they did not take the required time to fully evaluate the situation. And the officers who responded to the Walmart had just undergone a training in active shooting situations where they were, according to the Cleveland Plain Dealer, where they were told to immediately act. It was really stressed in their head that time is of the essence. And I want to go back just a step and talk a little bit about more about this study that you guys did, the survey. And I just want to show listeners or explain to listeners how dramatic these disparities and how much emphasis there are. You guys looked at median number of hours spent on various training priorities. Use of firearms, as you said, dominated. Recruits got a median of 58 hours learning how to properly use their guns. Then came defensive tactics. And when you add to those the hours they spent learning about using their batons or pepper spray or tasers, the median police recruit got 168 hours of training in the use of violence. But in terms of avoiding violence altogether, it was a totally different story. The median recruit got 8 hours of training in conflict de-escalation and 8 hours in training in crisis intervention. And that last one is important because, according to the Washington Post, 26% of Americans killed by police officers this year showed signs of mental illness. So 8 hours in crisis intervention. What about continuing training for cops? That was the picture with new recruits. Is that something that you see a similar picture in?
Yeah, no, that's called in-service training. These are officers who've been on the job for a while. And, you know, what's interesting about that is we found a sort of similar proportion of hours on firearms versus de-escalation. And, you know, you'll hear officers say, I have to qualify at the range. And they do. And by the way, we're not arguing that officers shouldn't be trained to use their firearms. Of course they should be trained. We're simply saying that in the world we live in now, especially as you point out, with dealing with the mentally ill or dealing with the homeless or dealing with emotionally disturbed people, a whole new set of protocols are necessary. You know, one thing that is thrown around a lot is this notion of de-escalation. I don't really think, you know, I don't think we know what that term means. We don't know how to de-escalate situations. So that's one of the skills that we need to teach officers. And it ought to be just as important to teach de-escalation skills as it should be to use a firearm if necessary. And then there's all of these less lethal technologies or weapons, if you will. You know, there's batons, there's pepper spray, and there's electronic control weapons, or as sometimes called tasers, and how to use them and when to use them and putting, you know, significant restrictions on them so that they're only used sparingly is very important. So, you know, too often, I think what's happened today in society, we live in a society where, you know, everything seems faster and communications is faster and texting and messaging and Twittering and all of that. And I think what's happening is some of the officers who are coming out of police academies are thinking, you know, look, I have this individual and they're acting erratically. Which of my technologies can I use to get this person under control? Should I use a gun or should I use a taser or should I use a baton, whatever? And they're not thinking. The first thing that they should be thinking is, what do I have here? What is the situation? How can I use my communication skills? How can I take this person at a very high anxiety and bring them down? You know, one of the really interesting observations, if you think about it, in a number of these cases, and I've asked women about this, is why is it that in many of these situations where a woman is involved, they wind up not using a higher level of force, and they wind up getting people under control. And when you ask them why that is, they will tell you that a lot of it has to do with the fact that as a group, and of course there are differences, you know, when you look at them specifically, women tend to use communication skills and problem-solving strategies first. That's the kind of way that they approach that. And so there's something to be said for looking at these kind of situations, and that's one of the things body cameras will do, is we will, you know, someday be able to use footage from body cameras to show how someone took a very difficult, volatile situation and brought that person, you know, down slowly and brought them under control. With a mentally ill person, the worst thing you can do is shove a gun in their face and start barking orders at them. It's almost counterproductive, because it, especially if you have someone who really is in crisis, and we've seen this, there's videos of this, we have them. When you pull out a gun, we've actually seen them start walking toward the officer. Maybe they have a knife or a screwdriver, and they start saying, go ahead and kill me, go ahead and kill me. And we would, you know, psychologists would, in retrospect, look at those situations and say those were suicide by cop situations. Those were situations in which the person that the police were dealing with really was in such agony and pain that the best solution seemed to be to have a police officer kill them. And, you know, we've seen evidence of that over and over again. So the key is, how do you recognize this behavior? How can dispatchers, very, very important, assess the situation by getting information from who's calling it? I mean, like, say if it's a mother and it's about her son, well, tell me about your son. Oh, he's a schizophrenic, he's off his medicine. You hear that, you immediately going to respond differently. Maybe you'll have multiple cars. Maybe you'll get a social worker if they're available, because you've already developed those relationships. So, you know, information is power, and, you know, the whole decision-making process should be, you know, slowed down in these kinds of situations as opposed to the active shooter situations.
If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with Chuck Wexler from the Police Executive Research Forum. Chuck, the report goes further. You call for a rethink of police culture in addition to training. And I think that's a crucial issue here. I have two questions about this. First, it's hammered into the heads of police officers from the academy through their daily briefings that the most important job is to go home in one piece. Can you share your thoughts about that bit of conventional wisdom within the police?
You know, that is the conventional wisdom. And, you know, I have gone to a number of police funerals, and it's one of the saddest things. There's no question, to lose a police officer. Just lost one in New York the other day, and I've been to funerals in Philadelphia and Boston, where I'm from. So there's no question, this is, you know, it's a horrible thing. However, the notion that the most important thing is for an officer to go home safely at night, we don't say that that isn't important. It absolutely is important. But it shouldn't be put in the context of that is the only thing that's important. Because, look, police officers take their job and do their job because they're willing to take risks that other people in society aren't. So we recognize that there are certain situations, like the active shooter situations, where officers must be willing to, you know, step in front of the bad guy and get between him and innocent citizens. And so risking their life is part of the job. We know on 9/11/01, police officers and firefighters were running into the World Trade Center when everybody was running out. But it's important to also recognize we're talking really about the big picture perspective, which is the sanctity of human life. And even someone who's, you know, causing harm to themselves or others, their life is important. And so, so simply to say that, you know, the most important thing is that an officer go home safely at night really misses the point of why someone becomes a police officer, and that is to serve the greater good of the community. That doesn't mean, you know, at their own expense, but there are situations where, because of the nature of what policing is all about, is that you have to put the community above everything else. And so you will see in police departments like in Las Vegas and others where they use the terminology sanctity of human life. Well, that is a huge, you know, change from the notion that the most important thing is going home safe at night. The most important thing is for both officers and the people they're dealing with to both go home safe at night. It shouldn't be one or the other, but so that gets at the culture, because people should not take the job of police officer if they feel as though they're not willing to take risks to protect their community. They should not take unrealistic risks, but we should not talk as if that's the only concern, them going home safe at night. And that's an important distinction to make, and one that, you know, I think the win-win is both the officer and the person they're dealing with goes home safely.
Chuck, we're coming to the end of the segment. My final question before I let you go, and this gets also to the culture. To what degree are officers taught, in your experience, to establish their authority in a potentially violent or chaotic situation, to take control? And let me tie that to the idea that there are times when the best move is to perhaps back down. Is that considered, right. I don't know, unmanly or, right. or lacking in toughness?
Well, that's a really good question. That's a really good question because, look, why do people become police officers? Well, there's probably a number of different reasons, but the people who generally want to become police officers are ones that want to make a difference. They're problem solvers. They want to, you know, engage, get to the location, help someone, make a difference, and that's all admirable. But we also recognize there are certain situations where, you know, accelerating a situation so that, you know, you're acting precipitously or faster than you need to can maybe either put your life or the person you're dealing with life in jeopardy. So when you have, let's say you have an emotionally disturbed person and he's got a big stick and he's hitting, you know, he's trying to hit people, the most important thing might be to simply get that person in a position where a number of people are surrounding them and starting to talk to them and waiting for additional resources. And, one of the things we're looking at is how they do this in places in the United Kingdom. And actually on Saturday, I will leave with a number of police agencies for Scotland, where we will spend time looking at how they de-escalate these situations, handle these situations. And it's not considered backing down to step back. It's one thing to run away. It's one thing to avoid a call. It's entirely different to simply step back, get additional resources, get a supervisor, get someone from the mental health community, look at the situation and ask yourself, what do I have here and who is best to help me resolve it in a way that's safe for both the officer and the person they're dealing with?
Chuck Wexler, I believe we are about out of time. I really want to thank you for taking the time to speak with me today.
Well, thank you. Nice to be on your show.
I'd also like to thank Michael White and Mike Tomasky. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall. You can send an email griping about the show to politicsandreality@gmail.com. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes or Podbean. Of course, I want to thank all of you good people for tuning in. Have a terrific week.